My name is Paul Olson, and this is the discussion of J.D. Salinger's short story For Esme with Love and Squalor. And the theme of our discussion will be wholeness and holiness. How many people weren't here 2 days ago? Weren't here? Okay. Someone that was, maybe we can very quickly, you're okay if you weren't, and we'll just summarize where we are in the story so far. Just in terms of plot, we have this, and we'll take off from where we ended. You want to learn about the end of the world? This is J.D. Salinger. It's the one you want? Beginning. Yeah. Okay, who wants to just kind of update us on the story? Just real briefly, the plot, and then we can take off from there. Everyone will know where we are. It's real easy to do. Someone said to me yesterday, I'm looking forward to the session because I don't get the story. And one of my feelings as a literature teacher is to show you that you can get the story. And you don't need a teacher to help you. You can do it on your own. One of the things I believe is that I'm more experienced because I went to school a whole long time doing this kind of junk. But I'm sure not smarter than any of you. And so if I can do it, anybody can. And I know that's true. So we'll learn to do that today with this idea of criticism as consciousness after experience. We'll talk about that. But first, let's update our plot.
Paul, would you explain that word squalor in there?
Okay.
I think of squalor as being dirty and no money and that sort.
Well, I think that's part of it, dirty. But go ahead and add for your own feelings that you get about. I mean, here's Salinger, where we're going to begin today. He says, this is the squalid, or the moving part of the story. Just from your guts, what do you think squalor means? What?
Unpleasant.
Unpleasant, for sure, fits. Dirty fits. I mean, Clay is not, he's a kind of a dirty guy. You know, and Sergeant X has dirty hair. It's, you know, that's good. Anything else, though, that's squalor?
Well, it's squalid. I think it's storm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good answer, too. He's been through a lot of storms, hasn't he? War itself. And then other people he loves, and their response to the war has really been rather squalid, too. Unsensitive. Yeah, that's good. That's an important question. Yeah, thank you for asking it. It's a good one. And I think it'll even become clearer as we read the end. We'll see what he means by the squalid part of the story. But first, we have to have the plot still. You're doing work great, though.
She has this little brother with her.
Yeah, she and her little brother come in. Good. That's a very good summary. I mean, that really updates us. And then really, in terms of the complexity of the plot, not a lot has happened. He's going to go into war, and he meets this girl. And she leaves, asking him to write a story. And then analysis of the age and how that's ambivalent between is she older, is she younger? We don't know. We know she's young, and there's a lot of clues to that, but she's been through a lot, hasn't she? Which makes her seem rather adult. Well, as we look into the second half of the story, the squalid part of the story, we'll look at what is real clear as psychological conflict. And one of the things that I'd like to point out about the difference between good literature and great literature, I think, is that great literature deals with conflicts even deeper than psychological conflicts. Psychological conflicts are painful, and they're important. When we write stories that deal with that, it's important. And I suggest to you a story that might illustrate that. Sophie's Choice. If you read the book by William Styron, or saw the movie with Meryl Streep, you know that It's a story of great psychological conflict. If you saw the movie only, this is what you got. The pain of her psychological conflict. That is, she had to make this choice, and I don't give anything away because experiencing the story is different than knowing the plot of it. She had to make this choice, we learn at the end, of choosing her boy, her son or her daughter to live. The other one will go to the concentration camp and eventually be killed. She knows that. And that's the choice she has to make in about 2 seconds. Well, there are a bunch of other choices that she's had to make, you know, preceding that too. But this is the final one, and the psychological pain and the emotional pain of enduring the concentration camps herself and of enduring the loss of her mother, her father, her husband, and now one of her children is all part of that, and it's shown in the movie. If you pick up the book, the first thing I think that'll impress you is that you think, wow, this is really full of sex and violence and drugs. It's a lot about that. And if we read the first 100 pages and we get caught up in the sex and the violence and the psychological drama and the psychological conflict that's going on, many of us might just throw the book away because it's so blatantly and specifically, anatomically even, sexual. Say, oh, I don't want to read it. But if we keep going, we understand, and the movie doesn't show this, and what I'm trying to illustrate is the depth of literature and what it comes to finally when it rises up to be great literature. And I'm suggesting to you that Sophie's Choice is perhaps one of the great novels of the century. Sophie says to the narrator in that book, which you don't get in the movie, Stingo. She's a concert pianist, by the way. My favorite song is Handel's I Know That My Redeemer Lives, but I can't play it anymore because I know that my Redeemer doesn't live. Where was God? And then she's done. And then the narrator asks, where was God in the Holocaust? Well, the book is about a response to that. Where was God in the Holocaust? Well, then, in the end of the movie, Sophie and her lover commit suicide together. In the book, and it's not clear in the movie at all, in the book they commit suicide together, and on their phonograph the record is playing, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desire. And it's a painful story about her loss of her God and how she can't believe anymore after experiencing the Holocaust. And it becomes then metaphysical, theological conflict, and it's a deeper, richer, more universal kind of story that we all respond to. Maybe we haven't lost our God, but we are all filled with the kinds of doubts that Sophie has experienced only so dramatically. I'm suggesting to you then that we'll see in For Esmeer with Love and Squalor, a psychological conflict. This guy is going crazy. But beneath his craziness is something even deeper. And what matters then to Salinger and our understanding of the story, and you'll see it as we go through it, is that what can save him? Psychological therapy? His pain is in this area. Therapy, sex, drugs, and a lover did not save Sophie. She needed God. Sergeant X is somewhere in that balance too. And I'm just trying to suggest to you the depth of this conflict that we'll see. Now, one last thing before I sit down, we'll just read the dialogue of the story. I believe, as a teacher and student of literature, that criticism, I like this phrase, it's not mine, I wish it were, criticism is consciousness after experience. If you're here Thursday or Wednesday, I guess it was, apologize for using the same illustration, but I think it makes it so clear. We all have experiences, and then we reflect on them. Or we talk with a friend about them, or someone we love or something, but we talk. And what we're doing is heightening our consciousness about that experience. I would suggest to you, as a student of literature, that we can all do that. And that sometimes we sit back after we look at this and we don't get it right away. That's normal. I don't get it all either. And I've read For Esme lots and lots of times. It's still something new. I know that you're going to teach me something today. I know you are. That's why I love to be involved with this. But you can too. So what we'll do is reflect on, and I'll just say from your guts, how do you feel about what Clay says? And you'll respond. And that you're in the process then of, first of all, from your guts and your heart, reflecting on this experience, heightening your consciousness, and then gradually that moves to your intellect, and your intellect and your heart move together, and you're a literary critic. I would suggest to you that literary criticism is what we all go about every day, trying to figure out the meaning of our experiences. And literature just is another way to do that. Okay, are there any questions so far? Those of you who weren't here 2 days ago, are you clear enough on where the story is going to take off from? Our hero, the guy that met young Esme in the cafe, has gone to war. He went to war on D-Day, and he's back now. VE Day is over, the war is over, and he's in a mental hospital, which is just a converted house. That's a very good response, and you are just, the questions and responses that you made suggest that you are already doing very good literary criticism. One, to pick out that the watch is important. It must be important to Esme because it doesn't fit her. You know, if you're going to get a watch that looks good, it's got to fit. He thinks it ought to be worn around her waist, in fact, it's so big. But it belonged to her father. And you wonder about Sergeant X being a father figure. Anytime you ask a question about a literary episode or a literary experience, you put it in the context of the whole story. It's like we do our individual experiences in life. We put it in the context of our whole life and begin to answer it. At one point she says to him, I'm trying to put it in a context now, that you have already done, whether consciously or unconsciously, I don't know. You're the 11th American I've met. I mean, she's looking for something, it seems. And she initiates a conversation. She's the one who asks, well, are you with troop movement? I mean, she doesn't mess around with the weather. She gets right down to things that a father, might be able to answer for. So it's a real honest and a good response from you about where the story is going. And of course, at the end, the watch will be very important. Anybody else? Well, we ended with Esme saying, I hope you return from the war with all your faculties intact. What we want to just lift up about that is that Esme, with her father killed and her mother dead, and her father, S-L-A-I-N, and her mother dead, and she having been evacuated, understands that perhaps death isn't the worst thing that could happen. But returning with your faculties not intact may be. Yes? Yeah, I'll start now on page 103. What I'll do, and you'll be able to keep up, I'll just skip through and for the most part look at the dialogue of the story. And that'll get us through the story, and you'll get the feeling of it, and I encourage you to read it if you have a chance. So we have time to discuss it, I think. So I won't read everything that's here. You all can read, and read well, I'm sure. This is the squalid or moving part of the story, and the scene changes. The people change too. I'm still around, but from here on in, for reasons I'm not at liberty to disclose, I've disguised myself so cunningly that even the cleverest reader will fail to recognize me. You buy that? Not even slightly. So what's he doing? And again, it's not in my notes, so you got to tell me. Why does he say that? He doesn't want to be insane, for sure.
Nor does he want to be anonymous.
And good. I don't want to go insane, and I don't want to go insane all alone. I try to disguise myself, but I'm really not. You ever had your child or your little brother or sister or somebody just play a game where they kind of hide, but they want to get found because it's just too scary in the basement all alone for very long? I've disguised myself so cunningly that even the cleverest reader will fail to recognize me. It was about 10:30 at night in tell me how to pronounce that. Deutschland, people? Goffert? Goffert? Goffert, that's what I've said, okay. Bavaria, several weeks after VE Day, Staff Sergeant X was in his room on the second floor of the civilian home in which he and 9 other American soldiers had been quartered even before the armistice. He was seated on a folding wooden chair at a small, messy-looking writing table with a paperback overseas novel open before him, which he was having great trouble reading. Now, Salinger's at his best in describing, the particulars of his pain. The trouble lay with him, not the novel. Although the men who lived on the first floor usually had first grab at the book sent each month by special services, X usually seemed to be left with the book he might have selected himself. But he was a young man who would not come through the war with all his faculties intact. And for more than an hour, he had been triple reading paragraphs, and now he was doing it to the sentences. He suddenly closed the book without marking his place. With his hand, he shielded his eyes for a moment against the harsh, wadi glare from the naked bulb over the table. Watch his physical response to the war. He took a cigarette from a pack on the table and lit it with fingers that bumped gently and incessantly against one another. He sat back a trifle in his chair and smoked without any sense of taste. He had been chain smoking for weeks. His gums bled at the slightest pressure of the tip of his tongue, and he seldom stopped experimenting. It's a little game he played, sometimes by the hour. Wonderful exacting phrase. Utter despair. Just sits and touches his tongue to his gums, bleeds and spits. And all of us have looked at a book somewhat mentally ill then, haven't we? Like, read it. What did I just read? But you're right. They can't concentrate, and he can't. And we'll watch that even grow. That's good. He sat for a moment smoking and experimenting. Then abruptly, familiarly, and as usual, with no warning, I love this sentence, he thought he felt his mind dislodge itself and teeter like insecure luggage on an overhead rack. The pain of going insane is heightened because he is so conscious of it himself. He's not just slipping out of reality and not knowing what's happening to him. He feels, he's aware of himself going insane. He quickly did what he'd been doing for weeks to set things right. He pressed his hands hard against his temples. He held on tight for a moment. His hair needed cutting and it was dirty. He had washed it 3 or 4 times during his 2-week stay at the hospital in Frankfurt on the Main, but it had got dirty again on the long, dusty jeep ride back to Gofurt. Corporal Z, who had called for him at the hospital, still drove a jeep, combat style, with the windshield down on the hood, armistice or no armistice. From your guts, what do you think of Corporal Z? Right away, our first introduction to him. What? Macho, yeah. This is the John Wayne movie. And here he is. Yeah, and that might be that this guy's coping in a different way. And we'll get to know him a little better as we go. There were thousands of new troops in Germany. By driving with his windshield down, combat style, Corporal Z hoped to show that he was not one of them, that not by a long shot was he some new son of a bitch in the ETO. Some guy just coming in to mop up afterwards. I was in the war. And that's that nice word, macho, yeah. This is an important paragraph. As we read it, see the pictures, but also feel what Sergeant X must have felt. When he let go of his head, X began to stare at the surface of the writing table, which was a catch-all for at least 2 dozen unopened letters and at least 5 or 6 unopened packages, all addressed to him. He reached behind the debris and picked out a book that stood against the wall. It was a book by Goebbels entitled Die Zeit ohne Beispiel, A Time Without Precedent. It belonged to the 38-year-old unmarried daughter of the family that, up to a few weeks earlier, had been living in the house. She had been a low official in the Nazi Party, but high enough by Army regulation standards to fall into an automatic arrest category. X himself had arrested her. Now, for the third time since she had returned from the hospital that day, it's Theodore Reich, the psychologist, I mentioned this last time, who says, listen with your third ear. Don't miss that it's the third time he's gone to this book. He returned from the hospital that day. He opened the woman's book and read the brief inscription on the flyleaf. Written in ink in German in a small, hopelessly sincere handwriting were the words, Dear God, life is hell. Do you have the scene? 3 times. This guy triple reading paragraphs, his gums are bleeding, he knuckles bump when he tries to light his cigarettes. It's, Dear God, or not Dear Auntie, or Dear God. Life is hell. And who wrote it? Yeah, the enemy. What happens to X? Someone he had arrested because she fell into an automatic arrest category. Just your feelings. For sure, guilt. Yeah. And in identification, it's the enemy. Holy cow. The enemy feels pain too. This Nazi soldier. Listen to his response. Nothing led up to or away from it. Alone on the page and in the sickly stillness of the room, the words appeared to have a stature of an uncontestable, even classic indictment. X stared at the page for several minutes, trying against heavy odds not to be taken in. Then, with far more zeal than he had done anything in weeks, he picked up a pencil stub and wrote down under the inscription in English, "Fathers," now this is X writing, "Fathers and teachers, I ponder, what is hell? I maintain that it is the suffering of being unable to love." He started to write Dostoevsky's name under the inscription, but saw with fright that ran through his whole body that what he had written was almost entirely illegible. Right where we are, let your heart, your guts respond to this man whose mind is like insecure luggage on an overhead rack, trying to write in his book.
One's handwriting reflects the mood you're in, and he's in great despair, and so, you know, as much as he'd like to read what he wrote, he can't decipher his own feelings or his own words.
Good. For sure, good. He can't write. He can't light a cigarette.
I don't think he's feeling very lovable.
Yeah. What a wonderful statement about he's not lovable or loved. And lovable is, what do you do to be not lovable? Arrested someone in as much pain as he's in? Dear God, life is hell. But hell is now made pretty specific, isn't it? Is hell watching your buddy get killed? Uh-uh. Is hell watching somebody shoot a cat off the roof of your Jeep? Uh-uh. I mean, that happens in story. Hell is really specific for Sergeant X. The suffering of being unable to love. Now watch the responses that he gets from everybody who tries to help him. He shut the book. Here's response number one. He quickly picked up something else from the table, a letter from his older brother in Albany. It had been on the table even before he had checked into the hospital. He opened the envelope, loosely resolved to read the letter straight through, but read only the top half of the first page. He stopped after the words, "Now that the goddamn war is over and you probably have a lot of time over there, how about sending the kids a couple of bayonets or swastikas?" Response number one. I maintain, I'm not talking, this is X. Hell is the suffering of being unable to love. What's he need right now? What did he need before? Remember the letters he got before? Hey, send some cashmere yarn when you get away from camp. Yeah, just somebody give me some presents. I don't mean ENTS, but presence of mind and heart and all. Yeah. Send some bayonets or swastikas. And look what happens to him. With our third ear, we listen carefully now. After he had torn it up, he looked down at the pieces as they lay in the wastebasket. He saw that he had overlooked an enclosed snapshot. He could make out somebody's feet standing on a lawn somewhere. What's happened? What was the picture? We don't know, but guess.
The head is gone. The identity is gone.
He doesn't know who it is. Somebody's feet standing on a lawn.
He
right?
He doesn't care. I mean, people can hardly ever resist when he gets a snapshot. He's so far gone that he's been there.
Who might it have been?
It's
his brother's family or brother, or, you know, yeah. And somebody did try to give him some presents. Here's a picture. We all value those if you're up, you know, away from home a long time. Someone sends a picture. Hey, here's the kids. Here's how we're doing. But he didn't get to it because the request for bayonets and swastikas was too spiritually vulgar. And that prevented him from going a step further where they maybe would have had the picture. And who contrasts with that in this story? About, yeah. Who has some, I hope you return from the war with your faculties intact. Isn't it a shame we didn't meet under less extenuating circumstances? Do you love your wife very much, or am I being too personal? Think we'll get together in a method of, thank goodness there's an end to the method of existence that is ridiculous to say the least. She understands. Yeah, good. Well, then we have a new scene, and this wonderful character, Corporal Z, maybe is Salinger. This, I don't know. There are other people here who have read more literature than I have. I think this might be the best scene in American literature, 20th century short stories. We'll see. Who cares what I think? Huh? The door banged open without having been rapped. The door banged open without having been rapped on. X raised his head, turned it, and saw Corporal Z standing in the door. Corporal Z had been X's jeep partner and constant companion from D-Day straight through 5 campaigns of the war. He lived on the first floor, and he usually came up to see X when he had a few rumors or gripes to unload. He was a huge, photogenic young man of 24. During the war, a national magazine had photographed him in Hurtgern Forest. He had posed more than just obligingly with a Thanksgiving turkey in each hand. You're writing letters? It's spooky in here, for Christ's sake. X turned around in his chair and asked him to come in and to be careful not to step on the dog. What? Alvin, he's right under your feet, Clay. How about turning on the goddamn light? Your guts. Is there a dog there? Huh?
No dog.
No dog there. And somehow we know that. What's Clay? Well, watch Clay's sarcasm and responding. Not Clay, but X's sarcasm. Well, we can skip the, it's such a good, well-written paragraph, let's look at it. Here's how Clay is dressed. His brick red hair, just combed, was dripping with the amount of water he required for satisfactory grooming. Remember, how was X's hair? Dirty, he hadn't washed it for 2 weeks. A comb with a fountain pen clip protruded familiarly from the right-hand pocket of his olive drab shirt. Over the left-hand pocket, he was wearing the combat infantryman's badge, which technically he wasn't authorized to wear, the European theater ribbon with 5 bronze battle stars in it instead of a lone silver one, which was the equivalent of 5 bronze ones. Any of you ever have Cub Scouts in your family? Or were you ever a Cub Scout? I remember being a Cub Scout, and I remember my wolf badge was right here, and under the wolf badge I had 7, or I don't remember the number, little silver stars. But as soon as you had, let's say it was 7, I don't remember, you had to take all the gold silver ones off and put a gold one on. I hated that. Because I was so decked out in all these things, and I'd walk around and, write tickets to my friends on their bikes and stuff. It was really a chance to be official. And what's Clay doing? But playing the war game, isn't he? Not a lot unlike send us some swastikas and bayonets. He sighed heavily and said, Christ almighty. It meant nothing. It was army. Took a pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket, tapped one out, and put away the pack and rebuttoned the pocket flap. Hey, they got this terrific show coming on the radio in a couple of minutes. Bob Hope and everybody. X, opening a fresh pack of cigarettes, said he had just turned the radio off. Watch how, and here's our third ear, listen again, how Clay ignores everything X asks him to do. Undarkened, Clay watched X trying to get a cigarette lit. Jesus, you ought to see your goddamn hands. Boy, you got the shakes, you know that? X got his cigarette lit, nodded, and said Clay had a real eye for detail. No kidding. Hey, I goddamn near fainted when I saw you at the hospital. You look like a goddamn corpse. How much weight you lose? How many pounds, you know? I don't know. How was your mail when I was gone? You heard from Loretta? Loretta was Clay's girl. They intended to get married at their earliest convenience. She wrote to him fairly regularly from a paradise of triple exclamation points and inaccurate observations. All through the war, Clay had read all Loretta's letters aloud to X, however intimate they were. In fact, the more intimate, the better. It was his custom after each reading to ask X to plot out or pad out the letter of reply or to insert a few impressive words in French or German. Yeah, I had a letter from her yesterday down in my room. Show it to you later. Her goddamn brother's getting out of the Navy on account of his hip. He's got this hip, the bastard. Hey, before I forget, we got to get up at 5 tomorrow and drive to Hamburg or someplace. Pick up Eisenhower jackets for the whole detachment. X, regarding him hostilely, stated that he didn't want an Eisenhower jacket. Oh, they're good. They look good. How come? No reason. Why do we have to get up at 5? The war is over, for God's sake. I don't know. We got to get back before lunch. They got some new forms in we got to fill out before lunch. I asked Bulling how come we couldn't fill them out tonight. He's got the goddamn forms right on his desk. He don't want to open the envelopes yet, the son of a bitch. I suspect that few of you talk with this kind of language.
Can we see the games?
All of those of you who are... never mind. What's your response to all of that vulgarity? And what about it?
Offensive to me.
He said, so you don't like the language, you don't like Clay, you don't like the story, then? What happens? Well, I suspect no one here talks that way. I think we step back from Sophie's Choice at first. We step back from The Color Purple. I mean, two of the great novels of recent times, because they're full of that kind of explicit talk. I just finished reading Slaughterhouse-Five again, and it's full of it. There's vulgarity here. I write the word just to give us a sense that I think what Salinger's after is that this vulgarity is representative, symbolic of a worse kind of vulgarity. There's spiritual vulgarity too. And as offended as we are, and I think we're all with you in that, against this, there's something else too. And in the presence of this kind of vulgarity, / squalor, what can deliver you? What does it take to make you not be offended, not feel dislike Clay and so on? So I think we're there really, you know, our feelings, your feelings are accurate. Salinger wants you to have that, I think. Dang old Salinger, huh?
Yeah, but the vulgarity of rebellion, I guess, part of the fact
is he's rebelling against what isn't vulgar.
That's why
he's
rebelling against what isn't vulgar. That's why he uses all that language. Because
he wants to be on
the
other side.
Does it make him more macho
than
he talks that way?
It
makes him feel like
what I'm... The question that you ask fits, doesn't it fit the other... I mean, he's got this infantryman badge that he isn't authorized to wear. He has his Jeep with a, you know... doesn't have the glass up, because that means you're not in combat. He's got it down still. He calls those guys who are coming in afterwards who really didn't fight in the war, sons of bitches. So that's a good question, and yeah, it adds to his... let's play the war game.
Yeah, but you have to think that maybe it was his way of surviving. It wasn't his way, it would be in a situation like that.
Might be. And that's not... that's good listening, that's listening with your third ear, and that's very much Salinger, that is the only way to survive in the society to respond the way Clay does. X responds with sensitivity, and you'll see it in a minute, love, and he goes crazy. And I can add for you, although it isn't in the story, in the mythological family of the Glass family, and that's Seymour Glass and Sergeant X, this guy, and a few stories later, puts a bolt to his head. He cannot live in this society. Matter of fact, I think if we looked at Hemingway and his look at our society, Hemingway says, how do I exist? And Salinger asks, in all his literature, can I exist in this society and its vulgarity?
War has destroyed two people. One man has lost his mind, and the other one is a very empty person who depends on the buttons and medals and macho style. Yeah. But both of them are victims of war.
Yes.
Destroyed.
That's a very nice analysis. And that fits Salinger's purpose of writing. His initial purpose was, I want to write an anti-war story. But it's bigger than that, and as we'll see. It's not just against war, it's against, you know, that's a good analysis. Well, he doesn't want to go, but true to his sensitivity, Clay keeps talking. Clay, I'm at the top of 109. Clay suddenly looked at X with new, higher interest than before. Hey, did you know the goddamn side of your face is jumping all over the place? Watch me. X said he knew all about it and covered his tick with his hand. Clay stared him for a moment, then said rather vividly, as if he were the bearer of exceptionally good news, I wrote Loretta you had a nervous breakdown. Oh? Yeah. She's interested as hell in all that stuff. She's majoring in psychology. You know what she said? She says nobody gets a nervous breakdown just from the war and all. She says you probably were unstable like your whole goddamn life. X bridged his... Here's Salinger at his best. X bridged his hand over his eyes. The light over the bed seemed to be blinding him and said that Loretta's insight into things was always a joy.
What's amazing is all of these things that he's saying, these really wonderful put-downs, and it's hitting Clay right here.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we say
not doing it? What do you feel about these put-downs? You know, yeah, our insight is great. Or don't step on the dog. Or later he's going to say, I'm going to stay home and work on my stamp collection. You know, he can't even read, let alone put. Why? The sarcasm. What do you feel is he doing? That he's doing?
Kind of trying to create his own world that he's
living
in. That cope in the world.
Yeah.
It really
yeah.
is just
like
creating his own little world.
Yeah. How do I cope in this world that I, in which I suffer because suffering is the end? Okay, well, see what kind of great literary critics you are? He's undaunted, though. Listen, you bastard. She knows a goddamn sight more psychology than you do. Do you think you can bring yourself to take your stinking feet off my bed? X asked. Clay left his feet where they were for a few don't tell me where to put my feet seconds and swung them around to the floor and sat up. I'm going downstairs anyway. They got the radio on in Walker's room. Hey, I was just telling that new son of a bitch, Bernstein, downstairs. Remember that time I and you drove into Boulogne and we got shelled for about 2 goddamn hours and that goddamn cat I shot that jumped up on the hood of the Jeep when we were laying in the hole, remember? It's a wonderful paragraph, you got it? You remember that, Clay saying, when I shot that cat off the roof of our Jeep, to the hood of our Jeep? Watch and feel the dialogue and the tension in the dialogue. Yes. Don't start that business with that cat again, Clay. God damn it, I don't want to hear about it. No, all I mean is I wrote Loretta about it. She said the whole psychology class discussed it, in class and all, the goddamn professor and everybody. That's fine. I don't want to hear about it, Clay. No, you know the reason I took a pot shot at it, Loretta says? She says I was temporarily insane. No kidding, from the shelling and all. X threaded his fingers once through his dirty hair, then shielded his eyes against the light again. You weren't insane. You were simply doing your duty. You killed that pussycat in as manly a way as anybody could have under the circumstances. What the hell are you talking about? That cat was a spy. You had to take a pot shot at it. It was a very clever German midget dressed up in a cheap fur coat. So there was nothing, absolutely nothing, brutal or cruel or dirty or even, God damn it, can't you ever be sincere? Stop it there once. Here we have kind of the event that made the luggage insecure on an overhead rack. A cat up on the hood. Look at that cat. We shot it off the hood of the car. Listen to Clay or X's response. He's funny and we laugh. You know, he had it botched out. Clever German midget. But then listen to his last response. So there was absolutely nothing brutal or cruel or dirty or even... God damn it, can't you be... What's he saying? It was, wasn't it? Brutal and cruel and dirty and even absurd. You kill a cat? X suddenly felt sick and he swung around in his chair and grabbed the wastebasket just in time. When he straightened up and turned toward his guest again, he found him standing, embarrassed, halfway between the bed and the door. X started to apologize, but changed his mind and reached for his cigarettes. Come on down and listen to Hope on the radio, eh? It'll do you good, I mean it. You go ahead, Clay, I'll look at my stamp collection. Yeah, you got a stamp collection? I didn't know you... I'm only kidding. I may drive over to Estat later. They got a dance, it'll probably last around 2. Wanna go? No thanks, I may practice a few steps in the room. Okay, good night. Take it easy now, for Christ's sake. The door slammed shut, then instantly opened again. Hey, okay if I leave a letter to Loretta under your door? I got some German stuff in it. Will you fix it up for me? Yes. Leave me alone now, goddammit. Sure. You know what my mother wrote me? She wrote me she's glad you and I were together and all the whole war. In the same Jeep and all. She says my letters are a hell of a lot more intelligent since we've been going around together. Thanks. Tell her thanks for me. Well, good night. Well, it did. He shot the cat and he went crazy. Yeah. But anybody else have any sympathy for Clay? Or not, I don't know if sympathy is the word, but just...
He's trying to help him.
Yeah.
Dig into him. He would do.
Yep, that's it, that he would do.
I think he's a lot of sympathy for Clay.
He seems to have responsibility beyond responsibility for this man.
But he didn't know how to do it.
No, I mean, he just has no feeling, really, of how he can be helpful. He's a very bumbling sort of person.
Yeah.
But he's trying.
Yep.
In a way.
He's trying to get everyone else's.
Part of what I think all writers are about is to change the vision of the reader by looking at the vision of the characters. Clay is trying, he comes in, he says, "You want to go listen to the radio? You want to go get your Eisenhower jacket? I mean, you want to come with me?" He is reaching out, but he has no vision about what it takes to touch another person.
Well, at least this other person might be able to touch someone else who's more
involved. Yeah. But that person wouldn't be insane, probably. But you're right. He probably can reach somebody, and the only way he knows how. And so, what does it mean to reach someone? In this story, how do you reach? Esme's going to do it through the mail. And Clay can't do it with his physical presence after having been a friend with him through 5 campaigns of the war. And he met Esme for 30 minutes. Doesn't know her really from Eve.
But what if he had the other person, see what the other person is like instead of projecting himself onto that person?
Mm-hmm.
Esme might be embarrassed to be with him at these events, even if he goes to the dance or if he's going to act like that.
Yeah.
He might act that way to other people as well as to him.
Sure. Stay home and do my own 2 steps, huh? You don't have to be this guy. Well, let's look at the ending quickly, and then it's your turn to figure out what that is all about. X has a bunch of mail there on his desk, and I'm at the top of 112. He thought if he wrote a letter to an old friend of his in New York, there might be some quick, however slight, therapy in it for him. But he couldn't insert his notepaper into the roller properly. His fingers were shaking so violently now. He put his hands down at his sides for a minute and tried again, but finally crumpled the notepaper in his hand. He has not been healed at all. The theme of this look at the story was wholeness and holiness. And it's going to take more than a Clay. And then our question as we look at what Esme does is, how can it happen that someone who doesn't know him, who really doesn't love him, can do it? What happens between 2 people who don't love, 30-minute encounter, that it saves him. He's able to sleep. Now let's watch the ending and see if we can figure it out. He's aware he ought to get the waste basket out of the room because it smells, but he leaves that there. And then he finds the package in the middle of the page about. He saw it had been readdressed several times. He could make out on just one side of the package at least three of his old APO numbers. He opened the package without any interest, without even looking at the return address. He opened, that's important. We're listening with our third ear. This isn't from Esme. He doesn't know who it's from. By burning the string with a lighted match, he was more interested in watching a string burn all the way down than in opening the package, but he opened it finally. Inside a box is this letter. I hope you will forgive me for having taken 38 days to begin our correspondence. Point number one. What do you make of that? 38 days, count of the days. This 30-minute encounter, those of you who heard it or read it, you know, I heard it last time. Not much went on, 38 days though. I have been extremely busy as my aunt has undergone streptococcus of the throat, that's Esme, right? And nearly perished, and I have been justifiably saddled with one responsibility after another. However, I have thought of you frequently and of the extremely pleasant afternoon we spent in each other's company on April 30th, 1944, between 3:45 and 4:15 p.m. in case it slipped your mind. Well, your laughter suggests you got it. And something very important happened then. Yep, the statistics lover. That's nice. We are all tremendously excited and overawed about D-Day and only hope that it will bring about the swift termination of the war and a method of existence that is ridiculous, to say the least. Compare it with what? Send me some bayonets, yes, and swastikas. We're quite concerned about you. We hope you are not among those who made the first initial assault upon the content in the peninsula. Were you? My warmest regards to your wife. Then, I'm taking the liberty of enclosing my wristwatch, which you may keep in your possession for the duration of the conflict. I did not observe whether you were wearing one during our brief association, but this one is extremely waterproof and shockproof, as well as having many other virtues among which one can tell at what velocity one is walking if one wishes. I'm quite certain you will use it to a greater advantage in these difficult days than I ever can, and that you will accept it as a lucky talisman. Charles, whom I'm teaching, and Charles kisses me for hello, 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 love and kisses. Then the final ending. It was a long time before X could set the note aside. There's the writer at work for sure. In a simple little statement, it was a long time before X could set the note aside. What's happened already?
There's feeling in that.
Yes, it's the first time there's feeling and he can concentrate. He hasn't been able to do anything. Triple read sentences. He just, remember, and he's just read this whole letter, right? Let alone lift Esme's father's wristwatch out of the box. When he did finally lift it out, he saw that its crystal had been broken in transit. He wondered if the watch was otherwise undamaged, but he hadn't the courage to wind it. Find out. He just sat with it in his hand for another long period. Then suddenly, almost ecstatically, he felt sleepy. His story is over. The story of love and squalor that he wrote for Esme is over. But now we jump back into the present, 6 years later, to the time when he's got the invitation, right? And now he's telling Esme, 6 years later, hey, Esme, you take a really sleepy man, Esme, and he always stands a chance of again becoming a man with all his facts, is his experience. I mean, the ridiculous existence of war, and guys shooting cats off the hood of the car, and when we know what else happened. And he can't cope with it because of his sensitivity. Before we leave, we don't have a lot of time, we have to get something resolved. Just before, if you have this book, and I encourage you to, if you like sounds, or read to buy it, although some of the stories are impossible to understand, and don't feel bad if you don't. Anyway, before this is a story called Down at the Dinghy. Very quickly, a little boy runs away from home, his mother goes and gets him, and with her love and presence and great parenting skills, it's a great parent handbook, that little story is, she brings him up out of this boat that he's gone and run away to. And her love for him, and her ability to give him her total presence and meet him where he's at, brings him up out of his despair. He's a child caught in the rye before the cynicism and the pain come, because mother's love. Well, that's a contrast, I think, to what happens here. There's no mother love. There's no Esme. Is there any love between Esme and Sergeant X? Is it
understanding,
but not
understanding?
They vibrate on the same frequency.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is a very fundamental caring about each other as human beings. It's not love in the sense that we use it, but there is a very real sense of love.
Yeah.
I mean, it's caring.
Yeah.
It's about love.
I'm sure there are seminary students here who know this a lot better than I do, but there are a lot of Greek words for love, you know. But two, philia is another one, but I'm just going to write two to get us going here. Eros has something to do, I think nowadays we often put that into sexual only connotations, and that isn't how it was ever intended to be only that, but it has something to do with object, and that mother, son, there are objects there, and the son is somehow worthy of love and receives it, and mother or son to mother too. But agape love, what's that?
Christ-centered.
Compassion, Christ-centered.
Understanding,
undeserved. Unconditional. Selflessness, there's no object at all. Do you think in this story that a person would have the power to save X? I mean, can his wife come and save him, you think? He's seen war. I mean, we know his wife couldn't. She's too breathtakingly level-headed. We learned that in the first page. But even if she weren't that way, could she have saved him? Clay can't save him. Esme probably couldn't save him. And her person. But a broken watch that he doesn't even want to see if it works. I'm wondering if somewhere in this watch, the symbol of the watch, Coleridge says that symbols participate in the reality that they show. Well, that's kind of a highfalutin phrase for they go beyond. That is interesting, except we don't know that really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you do because you read Salinger.
Yeah.
And
I think it's interesting that the guy that's so insensitive, his name is Clay.
Yeah. Yeah. It sure could be. Glass family is especially fragile. Can one show someone else agape love? Part of its very description, as I understand that, is that there is no person involved. It's the force of love. It's almost a spiritual. Am I right? Love exists, therefore I can. Not Esme loving me, but a watch that stands for it. I think, remember Wednesday, if you weren't here, I suggested that Salinger is concerned about God and about Jesus and about the role that Jesus has played historically. And you know, remember, but he picked them at random, and that we're all too stupid and sentimental and unimaginative to look for the kingdom of God in our hearts. And Jesus knew that. That's all Salinger's work in other places. That means it's five. Love exists. Not a person, but the kind of love that's more powerful than the squalor I've experienced of war. What's your response to spelling faculties? We've had that trick.
I think it shows a connection between him and Andy. They didn't share that spelling of the word.
Yes. A word that's painful. My father was S-L-A-I-N, and my F-A, my faculties are in. I might make it. Through this painful experience. Not because of you, Esme, but because love exists and it's more powerful. Anybody seen the play J.B.? Flower rises up through the rubble. A powerful symbol. And even the atomic bomb can't crush. See how good you are at literary criticism?
I'd say you're awful good.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back.